back. Another Bulgarian they use as a killer. Take a look. You should remember him. This man kills for pleasure.
James Bond, that notorious, amazing Dr. No secret agent, is back. And half the world is out to kill him. As he pits his murderous talents against the Iron Curtain and its velvet women.
Well, I'll tell you something, Coltorni. You're one of the most beautiful girls I've ever seen.
I think my mouth is too big.
No, it's the right size. For me, that is.
From Russia with love comes Tatiana, bait for the trap. From the four corners of the world come the men and women who play a deadly, dangerous game of espionage.
Do not be alarmed, my friend. We will make you as comfortable as possible.
Ali Kerim Bey, head of Station T, Turkey. Krasnogransky, codename Grant. Chief executioner of Spectre.
My orders are to kill you and deliver the lector. All I do, it's my business.
M of British Secret Service. The woman called Rosa Klebb, playing a double cross.
Klebb.
Romanova. The door. Romanova!
Russia with love. They dance for him. They yearn for him. They die for him. From Zagreb to Sofia. From Venice to Istanbul. From Paris to London. Agent 007 cuts an inimitable path through the palaces and boudoirs of espionage.
Dems, you're hurting me.
I'll do worse than that if you don't tell me. I'm doing this under orders I know. And what are they?
Even if you kill me, I can say nothing.
Only the second James Bond thriller will be more exciting than the first.
Your time, Mr. Bond. You cannot escape.
I have been told that I must inform you that the following program contains adult subject matter, adult language, and spoilers. Now thank you and enter if you dare.
Son, layperson James Bond podcast. I'm Diabolu Frank, and with me is
the old dude.
And this time we're talking about the second James Bond movie, From Russia with Love. This is the first one that actually has the pre-credit sequence, and it was very short, though. I mean, it's what, maybe 2 minutes?
As far as timing something like that, you know that you're into credits and all the little finer details. With me, it's just about fantasy, and every once in a while I might count bullets or a lot of times I'm checking out how tall the woman is.
Well, in this first of the pre-credit sequences, you've got Bond in what looks like a hedge maze with another fellow who appears to be Vice President Mike Pence. Bond is armed, Pence is not, but the guy managed to lure Bond into a trap, and then he has a metal garrote that's built into his watch,
right,
which he manages to wrap around Bond's throat, choke him out to death, and then at the end, a group of men come at him, and you realize this has been a training scenario with bright lights and all these men clad in black. They whip a mask off of James Bond, and it turns out that this was just a person made to look like Bond. They're training right. this assassin, what's this fella's name? Donald Red Grant, for this particular mission.
Right.
And I was really, you know how much I hated the Calypso music from Dr. No.
Yeah.
And I hated how you have just a few seconds of the Bond theme and then they go into the dumb Three Blind Mice song.
Right.
I definitely, this was a huge improvement. It definitely set the tone of the movie better. And And I dug that they go straight into the credits, and it's the belly dancer with the credits being projected across her body as she's doing her various moves. This, just from the opening, just from jump, it already feels more like the Bond formula is already in place here. They know what they're doing now more than they did with Dr. No.
Mm.
And it was a good-looking belly dancer, but I gotta tell you, some of that stuff was just so cheesy, so tawdry. Like when she's doing the tassel twirl, and when she's just shaking her ass, basically, against the projection. I thought that was a little too cheeky, but it still felt like they knew where they were going.
But you're not from that era. Okay, let's talk about that for just a second, okay? I was about 10 years old when this movie came out.
Did you see it in the theater, or did you see it?
Oh, heck no, I didn't see it for another decade, and yeah, I probably saw it in a movie matinee theater.
Because
you got to understand, Bond was too racy for TV. But that's the whole point, see, you know. I didn't actually see this movie until I was about 20. In fact, I may have seen the movie on the Armed Forces television, you know, because that was when I was in the service during Vietnam. So, but then again, you know, on-base military movie theaters, they have matinees like on Saturday where they would show old films. I remember when I was about 8 or 9, I saw Godzilla versus King Kong at the Corpus Christi Navy Base. I remember going because I was friends with a boy that his father was serving, and so we went to the Saturday matinee on base. Cost a nickel, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been about 1963.
Okay. But you were saying in the times, how that sequence played in the time period.
Right. Well, for people back, we're talking about an era where most people were trying to live like Leave It to Beaver.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Ozzie and Harriet. Those were our models. Our parents tried to mimic them. You know? They wanted us to be them. To our modern day taste and sensibilities, it's ridiculous. To them, it was pretty racy. It was really pushing the boundary. And like you're talking about the music, still today, British people like to go to the islands to for vacation.
Well, and I didn't have a problem with the Calypso music within the locale
of shootings. Well, it's actually not Calypso music.
But the point is, as the Bond theme, though, is what I hated it for.
Right.
I hated it as you're trying to get a sense of who James Bond is and what this movie's going to be. And then,
I don't think I need to give you a spoiler alert, but you're going to discover in the early Bond films, that island kind of music is in all of them.
Yeah. Well, and like I said, in the location sequences, once they're in the Caribbean, that's great because that gives you that local flavor. And it was actually an issue with this movie. They sent a music guy to Turkey to get a sense of the music. And, you know, to play on an old joke, it sounded like something playing in a taxi cab in the 70s, 80s. They thought that the sound was ridiculous and there's no locale music, a local flavor in this movie.
Right. And it's Turkish music.
Well, it's funny because Paquita's been to Turkey and she has it's like her favorite country she's ever visited as a globetrotter. And she actually has some Turkish pop music and it's pretty good, but it's still, you're juxtaposing like pop sensibilities and techno sensibilities to those vocal stylings.
Right.
So there is a little bit of a cognitive dissonance for a Westerner.
It would have been different then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, very well. I don't think they had any idea of what that music was like then.
Back in those days, they would have been in no way cued into Western music.
And vice versa. Obviously, when they went to Istanbul, they're like, what the hell is this? We can't use this.
I saw it while you were watching that director's stuff.
The commentary,
the commentary that I overheard that,
Okay.
Oh, but getting back to the opening sequence, we jumped over that. You know, the difference of what you were talking about and saw, all I noticed was that Sean Connery was wearing heavy gray theatrical mute.
Yeah, I didn't notice it as much at the times. I just thought it was supposed to be like Moonlight.
Man,
but on the second viewing, it was like, oh wow, these.
I noticed it. It made his eyebrows look twice as long.
Yeah, and dark by contrast too.
Yeah, because it was, you know, it was basically a dead man's face. It was the color of gray that you often see on bodies at funerals. So you know.
So it was nice that they were giving you that tell if you were looking for it.
Huh?
It was nice that they gave you that tell. They gave you the option of seeing that something was amiss in that opening sequence.
Oh, but I noticed it. And, of course, you know, I've seen that film so many times now. You know, we're watching my DVDs of the Bond films. That, you know, I've noticed it before. But yeah, it's something that every time I watch the movie is almost fresh.
Mm-hmm. So here's one thing that did get me, though, is they are still working on the formula. So during the credit sequence, they're playing the John Barry arrangement of the Bond theme. I don't remember the name of the fellow that conceived of the original music that they adapted to turn into the Bond theme.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're expecting the theme song, which is a staple of most of the Bond movies. You do eventually get the theme song, but it's teased, and then it's at the very end of the movie instead of in the beginning. And what bugged me is this movie suffers a bit from sequelitis in that they're figuring out the formula, and they figured out what they were told what people liked about the first movie, and so it seems like they're trying to give you twice as much in the second movie, which is a problem that a lot of sequels fall into. But I mean, sequels were still a somewhat foreign concept at this point in time. I mean, there weren't a lot of sequels up to this point, right?
Of what, the Bonds?
No, in general, movie sequels.
Tell you the truth, other than some of the movies made in the comedies made in the 30s, like My Man Godfrey and those,
mm-hmm.
I can't recall.
The Thin Man movies would have been a series.
Yeah, Thin Man.
Charlie
Chan. You know, but then again, a lot of people back then, they didn't call them sequels, they called them serials. So.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, I imagine the movie serials too, because I know Flash Gordon had several of them. They did several Supermans.
Well, and I think that's why they just carried the term over to other things, because mm-hmm. a serial and a movie is two different things, really. But
they tended to look down on serials, though, right? That it was like the way that movies always look down on television. It was a lesser medium as far as they were concerned.
Well, I can tell you this. Even when I was a little boy, a lot of times the serial was more important than the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe, yeah, people poke fun at it, but it was one of those Hollywood point of sale mm-hmm. things that worked. People went to the movies for
the
serial.
The characters, so you're going back to revisit those
characters.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah. You know, you had the Roy Rogers and the which was, by the way, my favorite serials
mm-hmm.
when I was a boy. It was Roy Rogers, man.
So he was in serials before he was on TV?
Well, and he also, you know, he also made some movies. He was the singing cowboy.
Mm-hmm. I thought Gene Autry was a singing cowboy.
Well, he was a singing cowboy. Okay. You know, those terms like Gene Autry and Gene Autry was never a big deal to me. I mean, he was, like we discussed before, a lot of my heroes were World War II people, and of course Gene Autry was so highly decorated, you know, I kind of idolized him for that, but as a singing cowboy, not so much,
mm-hmm.
you know. Roy Rogers was, and it really wasn't Roy. It was really the Jeep Nellieville. Mm-hmm. That was my big deal, you know, because, you know, if you look at Roy Rogers, as long as he was doing that stuff.
By the time I came along, I probably started going to movies off and on in 58, 59. Roy Rogers, things changed. If you look at the way that progressed,
mm-hmm.
the Jeep and the Nellieville kind of came in the later ones.
So what is Jeep and Nellieville, too? I have no idea what you're talking about.
You know, he had his screwball sidekick that drove a Willis Jeep from World War II.
Okay.
And a lot of those things, it was actually a character, if you want to get technical about it, and the Jeep's name was Nellieville.
Okay. So when you're saying, okay, I get what you're saying.
Yeah, my second car was a 1966 Rambler American,
mm-hmm.
and I used to call it Nelly. I had to give it that name, and people used to ask me, I go, oh, what's all this Nelly stuff? I said, my car's name is Nellieville.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know, so yeah. I plagiarized the entire name. But it was a convertible, so.
So was there anything else you want to talk about with the credit sequence, though?
No, because like I said, you know, I don't... In fact, when I watch movies on DVD, I zip past the credit sequence.
I wouldn't do that with Bond, though. I love Bond credit sequences.
Well, but your sensibilities and things you like about... That's why I thought this would be a good idea. We're so different about a lot of the things about film.
Yeah.
You know, reading credits is not my thing.
Well, I'm not reading the credits. I'm looking at the girls and seeing the cool artistry related to presenting those credits.
Right.
But I mean, I'm not going to sit here through like the Superman credit sequence just to watch the whoosh, over and over again, because 15 minutes later, your mind is goo, just like, ooh.
Yeah, but see, you actually read that stuff, and I don't, you know.
That's what I'm saying, though. It's like with Bonnie, I'm not really necessarily
credit,
reading.
When it comes to credit sequence, I may look for movie credit. That's the only thing about credits I might watch is I'm curious about music that I heard.
Yeah.
You know, because every once in a while, I'll be watching something, and there'll be a tune in there that I completely forgot about, and I don't remember the title. So yeah. I'm going to look at it, and I'm going to jot it down, then run and see if I can find it. Yeah, I just, the song Love is Blue.
Oh, yeah. Claudine Lange.
Right. Well, everybody refers to it, but she was not the one that had the first big hit on it. Mm-hmm. And actually, the big hit here in America was the instrumental that was done for the movie Romeo and Juliet in 1968. Mm-hmm. And I ordered I already had the Claudine Lange version.
Greatest hits, yeah.
But I ordered a couple of the other versions that made it to American radio, and I'm still waiting on the instrumental version to come. I ordered a new copy from England, so I guess it'll be here in a week or two.
Okay, so we open up with the chess match. And I think it's a fairly obvious set, but it's a really nice set. And one thing I find with older movies is it's a lot like me watching 3D. I pay attention to the 3D for like 5 or 10 minutes, and then I forget about it and just get lost in the story. I'll watch an older movie. It's obviously on a set. I accept that reality, and then I just get into the story if it's any good. So I didn't mind that, and I actually loved the set design, and I especially liked you're watching people play chess. But what they've got in the background is this large wooden display where it's the chessboard, and you're seeing big wooden icons for the king, the knight, and all that kind of good stuff. And people are actually taking those like shuffleboard hooks and moving the pieces around as the moves are being made. And today
didn't have LEDs in 1960.
Right, exactly. And today that's what it would be. But to me, I that analog approach I thought was fantastic. It gets me into that world of James Bond just seeing that. And then we're also introduced to Kronstein, who is this skinny, droopy-faced dude who's like the mastermind. And seeing him in that element and being clued in pretty early on through the cocktail napkin that has the Spectre octopus on it, letting him know it's time to wrap it up, and then he just wins the chess match and goes on about his business. I liked how they made it clear right from the start, this guy's an intellect, this guy is not somebody to be trifled with, and, you know, established that, you know, we've got our new, you know, mastermind for this episode. That goes into the introduction of Spectre, and I thought it was interesting because in the Bond books, it was usually Smersh that Bond went up against, and that was like the Russian equivalent of MI6. And I guess my understanding is they didn't want to trigger any additional Cold War tension, so they decided to turn it into
plenty in C3 without it.
Right. So they wanted to make sure to make the big bads into a separate organization that wasn't tied in directly to the Russians. They're an international criminal organization, and but it's still borrowing a Smersh plot from the books. And one of the other main villains, Rosa Klebb, was formerly with was it the KGB that she was working with?
No, formerly a colonel with Smersh.
Yeah, that's how they introduced the concept. And I like how, you know, I don't know if they've done that in movies previously where they introduce Blofeld but they don't tell you that it's Blofeld. He's just number one, you know, he's the head of the Spectre organization. Evil Octopus lets you know these are the bad guys, and all you see is him from the neck down stroking that white cat, which has become such a cliche. But I don't think they'd ever done that in film before, had they?
No, I mean, even the thought of a man sitting there petting a white kitty cat was, you know, that was, you know, that was even outside of exotic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, they do a lot of talking on the this and that of their thinking in retrospect in the special features and in the commentary track that you were playing. But just knowing the psyche of people back then, you got to remember the British invasion was fixing to happen big time in this country. The Beatles were already a known. British stuff was not only exotic, but it was cool and we could have it. For a British man to have a kitty cat was no big deal. You know, they had dogs and cats in Britain, and they have a special place in their heart for their pets and stuff. You know, they're kind of fanatical about them. But here in America, a man and a cat.
Well, we, especially back then, I think we had the concept of the British being more gentlemanly than us, more aristocratic. So we had.
The truth is, the accent, and it could even be a crappy British accent. Americans just ate that stuff of it, you know? And I'm sure part of it was a holdover from the war, you know? But part of it, the Americans just found it charming and alluring and sexy.
When I was looking up Rosa Klebb, she was the one of those had Colonel in Smirsch, and she's a very small woman. She's, what, like 5'4", would you say? Even
I think tall? She's less than that.
Like 5'1", 5'2"?
I don't know, but we could Google it real quick.
Okay. Well, anyhow, so she's a tiny little woman. She's an older woman at the time of the movie. I'd probably in her 40s, at least, if not 50s. And it's so cool how intimidating her presence is. She's so intense in that role that she more than holds her own against these other two nefarious individuals that she's working alongside.
Well, I thought the part where she punched the guy was laughing.
Yeah, when she's inspecting with Red Grant to see if he's as tough as she thinks he should be. So he stands up all rigid and she basically sneaks on a pair of brass knuckles and punches him in the gut and he pretty much doesn't react. That was great.
Yeah, I know for a fact up until the time I was about 45, that would have been less than a gnat that smacked me. And I was not anywhere near the shape that guy was supposed to be in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was just a joke.
But in looking her up, I saw that her name was Lottie Linya. And I was like, man, I know I've heard that before. Mm-hmm. And so I checked her wiki page and I realized when they made Mac the Knife a hit song for like Bobby Darin, they rewrote one of the names of the characters that are in the song into Lottie Linya.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for and she had apparently done it in a duet, I think, on the stage or something. So nice little tidbit. Did you find her height?
I'll be getting to it real quick here. She didn't die at 81. She was 83 then. So that means...
So she was in her 60s then.
20 years. 20 years would have been 61. Oh, crap. Like a lot of them old ones, they don't have her height.
Yeah. So what's the basic plot of this movie?
That there's worse things out there than the stinking commies?
Well, yeah, but I mean, like, overall, what's the plot?
You want a plot in a James Bond movie.
Well, okay, hold on. So the idea behind Spectre is they've decided they're going to pit the Russians against the British while they try to pursue a MacGuffin, this coding device that the Russians have. And so they've got a lead on a woman named Tatiana Rononova, and she works for these deciphering machines, and so they're going to... trick her into thinking that
she's doing it for Mother Russia because she's taking the machine from Mother Russia.
Right, because the communists have not allowed it to be publicized that Rosa Klebb had defected to Spectre.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to convince her to steal the device, to seduce James Bond, and to escape from Russia. So this actress they've got to play the defectee, though. Beautiful woman, lame character, though. I mean, they're just she seems to only exist to lust after
if
James Bond and look pretty.
Attention, they had to dub her voice back in.
Yeah.
Because of her accent.
And that's part of what killed me, too.
And then if you look, she was in a couple of spaghetti wedding westerns. I remember.
Yeah. They made this big point of, like, this big casting call where they had all these different actresses that were up for that part, and they will it down to her. And so she's this Italian actress. She doesn't speak English. They give her voice lessons. She doesn't quite get it down. They dub her voice just like they dubbed Ursula Andress's voice in the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
And they also dubbed Eunice Gayson's voice, who played Sylvia Trench, the girlfriend of Bond.
Mm-hmm.
They're supposed to be at the beginning of all these movies, but this was the last time that she appeared, and it just kills me because, again, the character is basically just a fembot, except she's good, you know, so she doesn't even have the agency of somebody who would be, you know, doing it for her own motivations. She's being tricked into it. She's an innocent, and so all she exists to do is be sexy for James Bond and run around naked or half naked. She doesn't have any personality, and all of her dialogue is handed to her by another actor who I assume is more accomplished, so it just feels like she's just a piece of meat in this movie.
Look, it goes back to all the prejudices of the time. You really have to live it to understand it. They wanted to make she's supposed to be exotic. She's supposed to be from another country, yet she has to speak near perfect English. You know, Chinese that were portrayed in a Chinese movie could only be extra. They had to have some made up white guy to be Chinese, you know? And the Brits weren't the only ones. And they did it even with the Indians, you know? And later stuff more within the British Revolution, you know, the British invasion, British Revolution, they would bring in Indians to play Indians, but for the most part, they had Brits and Americans. Peter Sellers used to play an Indian quite often. The prejudices of the time, I always found it kind of fascinating that Brits were a little more accepting of like American black people than the Americans were. I mean, they were more more cordial, more gracious, even if they didn't accept them, you know, as part of society. But to them, the Indians were the same thing as Americans, you know, Southern, a lot of Southern Americans felt about black people. Very strange, very odd. And, you know, and to be honest about it, you know, the Beatles did a lot to bring that stuff out, you know.
Well, I mean, they popularized, like, Hinduism and stuff. So, you know, they popularized the gurus and the Indian thought. So, they made it hip, and I guess the rest of the world became more accepting of Indians. I don't know how much of an impact they had on their homeland.
Well, but in the Beatle movies, they didn't use white people portraying other races either. They, you know, they allowed them to portray themselves.
So, the plot's in motion. And one thing that was interesting, too, is that Rosa Klebb is clearly a lesbian. They're not in any way subtle about that. And what's interesting,
and that was, like, you know, everybody, men of that era, I have spoken to men as an adult of that era, and I talked to your grandfather about it. And yeah, he'll tell you that, you know, they didn't even put that stuff in the stag films, that, you know, lesbian were taboo, but everybody knew they turned men on, you know. Which is another something, you know, I'm kind of weird in my generation. Most of the guys feel that way too. And with me, it's like, why would I be into something that has no interest in me whatsoever? And I don't get it.
Well, they're not interested in actual lesbianism. They're interested in lipstick lesbian or bisexual women, you know. So some that'll give you a bit of both.
Son, I have nothing against them. I've been friends with them. But as a sexual partner, I'm just not interested. And I don't care what they look like. I've known a lot of lipstick lesbians that were plenty good enough looking for me. But the mere fact that I knew that they were switch hitters, or I thought they were switch hitters, was a turnoff to me. Just like I don't get off on women with tattoos, you know?
Well, my thing is, I've got a decent gaydar, and I can usually spot lesbians, and there's just something there, I just, like, detect it, and I'm not attracted to, you know, full-on lesbians. I know they're not attracted to me, so that reciprocity is there. Might that be part of the trigger, is this realization.
Well,
like, oh, this person has no interest in me whatsoever.
Maybe I'm weird, I don't know. But I've never understood rapists. Why would somebody want to force somebody? And I've had, you know, I've been married several times. You know, the revenge sex, I get. But it's still something both parties want. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just don't get any of that. I don't see the attraction to it. It's not something that makes me hard.
Well, my understanding is the psychology of it is supposed to be about power. It's not about the sex, it's about dominating another person.
Well, and I've always been comfortable in my power and my manhood, so it's that, maybe that's it. Maybe I don't have any insecurities, and you have to be insecure
to feel the need to.
Yeah,
that's
the only thing, you know. Since you brought it up that way, that's the only thing I could think of. Yeah.
I think that's what I've read was this: is the psychology is this need to dominate another person, and you're getting off on the dominance, not the actual sexual.
Yeah, I took psychology 101, but I don't remember them even
touching on that.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting contrast too, because Bond goes into the office to find out about this case, and he is extraordinarily chummy with Miss Moneypenny, and, you know, in a way that you just could not get away with today in an HR department existing in every.
That's friendly flirting.
Yeah. Well, they were cheek to cheek at one point, literally like an inch apart.
Yeah, but Moneypenny was married.
Oh, well, I wasn't aware of that. But the point is, that works because both people are empowered, both people are clearly attracted, both people have actually recognized the boundaries. So as much as they'll tease and flirt, there's only so far they're willing to go with it.
Well,
so they're both comfortable. They're both happy, and it's consensual between the both of them. But then you see Klebb with Tatiana, and it's clear that Tatiana has no interest in Klebb, and Klebb is getting off on the discomfort of this young woman that she's fondling while she's informing that she's going to have to be in this mission or die.
But let's face it, both her and the chess cat, they were megalomaniacs into their power, and so yeah, they were the ones. And of course, Klebb was a dog, man. When you think about it, neither one of them were very good looking. You know, one was kind of sleazy looking, and one was over the hill, you know. No telling, I've never seen pictures of her when she was younger, you know, but I go for the petite ones, but she didn't look like she was all that attractive when she was younger.
She reminded me of the actress who played the first bailiff on Night Court, but by how she, her dimensions.
Yeah, only she wasn't
as heavy,
yeah.
No, the first one, not the second one. The second one was the gray-haired one that was more stout. The first one was real petite and just just like, you know, just acerbic though.
Okay, so, you know, I saw a couple of Night Courts and it was of the later variety.
Okay.
And see, that was another show I wouldn't miss. Night Court. Night Court just blew the doors open on prime time with what they got away with.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in the 70s when that came on, I wouldn't miss one. I thought it was one of the funniest shows on TV.
I love Night Court growing
up. But see, yeah. I don't remember the petite baby.
Well, because they had a thing where they had her and she died, I think, in the second season. And then they replaced her with another woman that had, who was a little bit more bubbly, but was still, you know, doing the whole Estelle Getty thing where it's like, you know, I'm an old lady, but I'm a cool old lady. I'm a biker and all this kind of stuff. And I think she died after like one season. And so that's when they brought in Marsha Warfield, who was a hell of a lot younger than those two. And I don't believe she was a chain smoker or anything like that. So she was able to survive the rest of the series.
Mm-hmm.
So this one introduced Desmond Llewellyn as Boothroyd, although they don't announce him as that inside of the context of the show. It's in the credits. He'll eventually become Q. And this movie introduced the concept of the gadgets, you know, with the gold sovereigns inside the straps of the briefcase, mm-hmm. with the knife embedded in the briefcase, the tear gas. Was there anything other gadgets too? Was that all of them in this one?
He had extra magazines and shells in it.
Mm-hmm.
I know they kind of pulled that same briefcase stunt in another movie, and it was explosive. So,
mm-hmm. But I liked how, even though they were cool, fantastic gadgets, they were still practical and realistic and totally believable. So I dug that.
Yeah, that's right. No, it wasn't extra magazines. It was rods filled with extra shells.
Mm, okay.
Yeah.
So they ship Bond to Istanbul, where he's going to meet up with the defector. And it reminded me about rear projection. This is another one of those accepted fantasy things. I remember as a kid being tripped out by rear projection. I didn't know how the hell they were doing that, why when they were in cars things looked weird and things didn't seem like it matched up correctly. But I got over it pretty quickly, and it's just, that's part of movie magic. And I wonder, people just can't seem to accept stuff like that anymore. You know, things like those, that kind of conceits, and just let the story, you know, carry on.
Well, you're talking about, that's all they had.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, they even did that in movies that were made like in the 30s.
Yeah. But it seems like there's this readiness to dismiss movies from this earlier time period just based on some basic technical insufficiency by modern standards.
Well, people are different and they're used to different technology. I agree with you. I mean, I agree with what you're saying. And that probably applies to me too. But I will tell you this, I liked live action better than CG action.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
And every once in a while, some director will demand that in a movie, and it does make the movie that much greater, even if there's CG added to it.
Mm-hmm.
So
Bond meets up with the bureau chief, the guys who are on the west side in Istanbul. It's Ali Kerim Bey, and you're talking about the whole issues with yellow face and brown face. So this guy's supposed to be Turkish, but he's played by Armendariz, who is apparently like a pretty famous Mexican actor.
Oh, well, I would have found her interesting.
Yeah.
Picture from the 20s, she was pretty hot. Lottie Lynn.
Doing the whole flapper thing, yeah. So this Pedro dude, he was a pretty big Mexican actor, and they got him playing a Turk. For me, I think he's pretty much the best part of the movie. I really enjoy the character. He you wonder about him at first because he has put his sons in all of his higher positions in his cabinet of you know, whatever the agency he's working for is. And so the first thing I'm thinking there is, oh, okay, nepotism. This guy's probably going to end up being corrupt. But it turns out he's just like a cool guy. It's like the Western agents in Turkey have an understanding with the Eastern agents, the Russians. They're not playing the kind of brutal games you see in other parts of the world. They follow us, we follow them, we're comfortable with each other. And, you know, he's got his mistress that he's with in the afternoons. He's got his sons working for him. He's just like, he seems like he's found a nice sweet spot in this whole spy game where he's not having to deal with all the cutthroat bullshit. But he's still, you know, totally game. He's helping Bond out. He's even though he's a bureau chief, he's actually out there in the field with Bond making things happen. And just a totally freaking cool guy. And so once I realized that he wasn't going to end up being a double agent or anything, I knew, oh, this guy's totally going to get killed. So that was a real fucking bummer, considering that became such a trope in Bond movies. Oh, you got a cool guy who's helping Bond out, they're going to totally kill that guy.
Well,
make him mad
as they went on, the guy would usually get seriously injured, but in the end, he would he would make it.
But in this instance, I'm not sure if that was something that was in the original script or something they had to work out, because the actor got to the set and he starts filming and he starts having this intense pain to the point where he can't keep acting.
Mm-hmm.
Goes to the doctor, gets diagnosed with terminal cancer.
Mm-hmm.
He basically is told you can film for maybe 3 more weeks and then you're not going to be capable of acting anymore. And so fighting through pain, he films all the scenes of the movie. For a lot of the long shots, they had to get a body double to pull it off, especially the stuff where he's trying to run around and be involved with action. And so he wraps his scenes.
Well, you know that scene where he's nicked by a bullet?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're looking at his face, that looks like real pain. He mm-hmm. probably was having real pain, made it that much better.
Yeah. And so he films his scenes. He goes back to goes back home and ends himself. So it's like, holy crap, you know? So I could see where, you know, especially in that time, knowing that in context, it's not just some bullshit, you know, trope of Bond. It's like, no, this was almost like, this is sad. This really, you know, this poor guy.
Well, and considering how it gives you an idea of the time, because back then there was no hope.
Yeah.
And people had seen enough people die of cancer to know, hey, look, if they want nobody to do it for me, I got to take care of it myself.
Yeah. Rough. So here's my first issue with the movie. So they've set everything up that Spectre's screwing around with both the Russians and the English. And so all these people are caught in the middle, including this gypsy camp. And so there's this long ass sequence where we're seeing a belly dancer, the same one that was during the credit sequence. We're seeing two gypsy girls fighting one another, teenage girls, by the way. And I gotta tell you, that belly dancer was freaking cut, man. I don't think I ever seen a woman from that era beyond like a Raquel Welch that was that like modern day caliber cut. Because I guess she'd been doing so much belly dancing, she had the freaking inguinal muscles and stuff. And damn, that was good to look at. I enjoyed that. But between her and the teenage girls with the halter tops tying off their dresses so they can basically be running around in bikinis having a cat fight, this was all just titillation. This doesn't have anything to do with anything. And then, of course, right. They have the big battle sequence.
For the era, that wasn't particularly attractive either.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because, well, see, that's the thing. It's like there's that sequence where Lottie Linya's character is coming in to inspect Red Grant.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a one who walks up and she's dressed in, you know, like seasonal clothing. You know, she's got a long skirt and top of everything else. So she just, boom, she just starts stripping in the middle of the grass, goes down to this guy, starts giving him back rub and stuff. She's just in a bra and panties, essentially. And she's
her build was more what men were looking for. A little bit plumpish, you know,
yeah.
Something to grab onto.
And today she would be a plus size model. And that day she was probably the ideal.
Yeah, no, I remember my own taste. You know, women I've been with, you know, simply because besides your mother, you know, her friend was my girlfriend back when I was a kid. You know how she was built. What some guys would almost call dumpy nowadays, that was very attractive, very sensual, you know, Doris Day look or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't change so much, really. Nowadays, people would go for the more of the twiggy look.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but they want Twiggy to have abs.
Right. And implants.
Well, but I remember at that time, Twiggy was outrageous. How could she model clothes? Why would anybody want Twiggy? She ain't nothing but a stick.
Very androgynous for the times, especially.
Yeah, nobody went for that kind of crap.
Well, they were talking about how, too, a number of actresses were invalidated for roles in the movie because they were just too skinny. They weren't suitable for the audiences
and
of the time.
You could go back. I mean, I'm telling you, look at Goldie Hawn, okay? Goldie Hawn's a good example. She was on Laugh-In. She was considered at the time, even though she had this real cute, pretty face, she was considered kind of skinny and silly and girl-like. And if you look at her parts that she got in the movies after Laugh-In, most of the shots they made from her was from the breast, top of the chest up. You know, that's when they tried to make her alluring and cute, show off her eyes and such. Her body wasn't what guys were looking for.
Speaking of bodies, too, I was really shocked that the defectee, when she's first seducing Bond, she's nude. You know, I had to go back and check. It's like, did I see what I thought I saw? You see her entire backside. You see the majority of her side boob. I don't think you see full-on nipple, but it's like, holy crap. They show it's through a gauzy drape. Mm-hmm. And it's I think it's a red tone, so you definitely have some coverage there. But she's still clearly naked. I was shocked to see
British
that movie.
Movie and not an American movie.
And they are a lot cooler about that sort of thing.
Well, they've always been. It's Americans have always been. I mean, they still are to a certain extent prudish about nudity. You know,
especially black chicks at the Super Bowl.
Wardrobe malfunction, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, but that is a good example. If they'd been a white chick, I don't think the fuss would have been as big as it was, which again is ridiculous.
Yeah, but getting back to the gypsy camp, you have this whole big action sequence of the gypsies versus the Russians, who are reprising because Red Grant keeps stirring stuff up. He murdered a Russian agent, and then the Russians supposedly tried to assassinate the bureau chief that was Bond's ally, and then now the Russians are attacking this camp, and it's like, I don't know, it seems like there'd be degrees. You don't go from killing one of our agents, we're going to kill your bureau chief, we're going to slaughter a gypsy village. Just like, wait, you guys are kind of getting out of hand a little early on. That kind of threw me off, but also
I think they're really trying to start crap between the Americans and the Russians.
Right, but the problem that I'm having is that this whole, it feels like a total tangent, and it eats up a lot of time, and I get what they're trying to do, but it just got kind of irritating after a while. Plus, there's a sequence where Red Grant's character saves Bond's life from a distance, because he's trying to keep Bond alive long enough to get the decoder device, right. But it makes Bond look kind of incompetent, because going in, he knows that there's a trap. He knows that there's obviously some kind of setup here, and yet he walks into every element of this trap, and he doesn't seem to be aware. He's not doing any detective work like he did in the first movie. He's just sort of blindly stumbling into situation after situation, and the fact that he's getting his life saved by the enemy just makes him look that much worse. I don't want to see Bond where he's completely invincible. And I know, like, it was a big thing when John McClane came around, because it was a return to the fallible hero, the realistic real life hero that makes mistakes and, you know, bleeds and hurts and everything else. But I don't know that I want Bond to be so oblivious to his surroundings that he's almost like a Kevin James character stumbling around through bullshit. He's capable enough to kill the bad guys, but he's not up to Bond's level of competency either. And it kind of bugs me, to be honest with you.
Well, I get that. And it's probably a generational thing. But then again, if you go to a movie like Austin Powers, where the bad guy's son is going, you know, why are you going through all this? Give me a gun, I'll shoot him in the head.
Right.
You know, in those early Bond films especially, they went to, everything had to be soap opera theatrical. Mm-hmm. You know, you had to use these means. And if you remember his instructions, his instructions was you have to not only kill him, you got to make it painful and humiliating.
Well, no, I think that was a situation, they made a point of mentioning that the guy was a psycho. I think they wanted to make sure that Bond got the decoder and that they could pin his death on the defector. And the Red Grant guy was going off script by wanting to torture Bond once it finally came to the point of killing him, which was not what he'd been ordered to do, but he was such a psycho that he was going to do it his own way. So he was basically screwing up the mastermind's plan by doing that, because it would have been obvious if you torture Bond that he hadn't been killed by his lover, you know? So
right.
So he was going to screw up the plan if he had gotten that far.
You know, nowadays in a police story, they tell you it goes to motive.
Mm.
You know, that because it was such a heinous kind of crime, you'd have to be emotionally involved to do it.
Mm. I also, you know, they go through this whole process of stealing the MacGuffin, where Bond keeps meeting Tatiana over and over again in different places to get different elements of the plan together. And, the Russians are killing the English and vice versa and all this stuff. And it just seemed like it was dragging out the story a lot. And
for the fact that you're missing the sexual innuendo there. She was, man, anything Bond wanted, she was willing to do.
Yeah, well,
I'm telling you, guys like that. You know, that means you want me. This is going to be fun.
Yeah, well, and it was fun, too, because there's a sequence where he's recording her telling him about the plan, you know, how the layout of the building is, so they can work out how they're going to steal the decoder, and she keeps dropping her, you know, flirtations in the midst of it, and so he sends the tape back to MI6.
And what is his reaction? He's determined to get through to it because he knows somebody else is listening.
Right, right, exactly.
And at the same time, look at his eyes. He's getting off on it.
Yeah, but it's funny watching the guys at MI6 listening to that tape.
I wouldn't be surprised if Sean Connery was walking around peg-legged after a couple of them scenes.
But it was funny, too, that they're listening to that back at MI6, and they make Moneypenny leave the room because it's gotten too hot, but they realize she's just listening over the intercom anyway, and I love how matter-of-fact she is about, yes, of course I'm listening.
Yeah, it was uncomfortable for the men, in, he knew Moneypenny was going to go out there and listen in.
Right.
That was always, and that's a running theme in all the movies. I mean, you've explained to me that you really hadn't watched Dr. No, you hadn't really watched this movie.
Well, what's funny is I have watched this movie, but I think what happened is I must have lost interest, because I remember certain scenes, and then the rest of the movie is just a wash for me. And I kind of, if we weren't doing this podcast, I was kind of feeling the same way. This is the kind of movie I'd want to watch while jacking around my, you know, tablet and just watch the cool scenes, because it's really freaking drags. There's a lot of boring sequences and a lot of extraneous stuff. Like, I didn't find the theft of the decoder device very exciting. I didn't like the sequence where the rats are running around. I thought it was lame how they set up these underwater canals under the city, and the Turkish bureau chief is watching the agents in their meeting room via a periscope. And it's just like, come on, guys, just fucking cut to the chase.
You are much more knowledgeable. I mean, you brought up the point. You're becoming middle-aged.
Mm-hmm.
The middle-aged man of 1963 and the middle-aged man of 2016, there is a world of difference between them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what would make those guys gaga, you find annoying and boring and maybe tedious. But that's all it is. You go back to movies of the 30s, they couldn't even do all, you know, there's no way they could do all that. So everything had to be kind of innuendo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the woman walking in with a silk gown and being standoffish, you know, at beyond arm's length, tantalizing, you know. And you'd probably find that, you know, it's like, hey, when is she going to get close and take that halo thing you got on the lens off? I want to get a look at this chick, you know. It's two different mindsets.
Well, no, but I can see that element too. One of the reasons why I like the Bond credit sequences so much is that there's nudity, especially in the later ones, and there's nudity in this movie, but it's so artistically done, it's so sweet and soft focus, and I find that much more sensual than the more overt stuff. I like that sweetness that it has to it, that naivete it has to it, and also because sometimes it's just more tantalizing what you don't see, or how close you can get to seeing something without actually quite seeing it, and so I get a lot of that too. I understand that.
Well, we can't say for certain, and they're not going to talk about that, but there's probably a good chance that some of that was they wanted to play in the American market, and there was only so much Americans the censorship would take. We didn't need a rating system in those days. There was no such thing.
Yeah, they were still operating under the Hays Code, as I recall.
Huh?
I believe they were still operating under the Hays Code then.
Whatever, but you know, if you watch some of the people that talk about that stuff that were doing films back then, they'll tell you a lot of that stuff was up to the particular censor on the set at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, but censorship, man, in America was a big deal. I always thought that was such a big joke, you know, that we were supposed to have all these freedoms, and yet we always had these big brother prudish
moral
attitudes,
majority bullshit,
actually filtering everything we saw and heard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're talking about, you know, if the president didn't want something broadcast that all the broadcasters knew, he didn't have to censor it. All he had to do was make a phone call to United Press or whatever and say, hey, you know, I don't want this. I want, you know, it could hurt our country. Just don't do that.
Mm. I dug the sequence where, and it was actually the point where I really started getting to the Ali Karim Beg character. I liked him already, but they've caught up with the main Russian agent that was involved with storming the gypsy camp. And he's hiding out in an apartment that's built on the side of an advertisement for an Anita Ekberg movie. And when one of Ali's sons goes to knock on the door, a window opens, and it happens to be the mouth of the Anita advertisement, and the Russian's climbing out of the mouth.
And Bond's attention has to be drawn to it as if
of course
he couldn't see it.
Right, no kidding. And so Bond takes out the stock of a rifle. He only has the stock. And he opens up the back of it, and basically it's a constructed sniper rifle. And the entirety of the rifle, the barrel, and everything else is within the stock.
Mm-hmm.
And it shoots like a .22, so it's a very small caliber. And so he's building this thing and getting ready to pop this agent. And since that's the guy who shot Ali, he's like, look, my arm's killing me, but you gotta let me have this shot. And Bond just like, yeah, of course, sure. So he actually offers his shoulder to help balance the rifle while he's trying to work it with his bad arm, and he successfully shoots the Russian agent. And that Ali had that point of, it was a point of pride for him, and Bond recognized that and was comfortable with allowing him that. I thought they were both cooler for that moment. That was one one of my favorite scenes of the movie.
Okay, but is your reference to two males being, I mean, I'm not sure what your reference.
They were obviously both respected each other, and they respected each other's abilities, and they understood that, like, it's sort of like in the, one thing that's interesting.
Okay, look, it's a point of honor. Mm-hmm. And if you pay attention in the old movie, it's just like when they were on the train, and he's getting ready to kill and torture Bond.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The Red Grant character.
And Bond says, look, for a cigarette, you know, he's trying to trick him to open that fancy briefcase.
Yeah.
For a cigarette, I've got these gold sovereigns in there. And he looks at him, you know, before they got to that part, he's asking for the cigarette, and he's telling him he's got money, he'll pay for it. And he says, oh, you know, British honor and all that stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was a running, you know, that was a thing.
Well, when Red Grant's character knocks out Bond.
You know, it's got to be cricket in the British movie, you know.
When Red Grant's character finally gets a drop on Bond, he knocks Bond out, he goes through his pockets, he steals Bond's money. Bond is asking for a last cigarette, and the guy's like, no. He's like, I'll pay you. And Bond's like, and Grant's character's like, with what? I already robbed you. Which shows where his honor is. And then that's when the gold sovereigns come up, and Bond also offers that the British government would pay him double to not kill him and let the Brits have the girl and the decoder. And the guy's like, no, I'm going to get off on killing you violently and slowly more than you can afford to pay me. So it shows why he's the evil, evil guy versus the Russian.
Well, and they do that in film today all the time. They got to make you, because he's going to kill the guy violently and nastily. Yeah, he's got to be in a situation where he absolutely has to do it, and it does not have anything to do with honor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all bets are off. This is an evil beast that must be killed, and he has no choice.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that. I mean, you can't miss that in almost any movie, especially one here in America. That nowadays we do have movies where you have anti-heroes and stuff like that.
But you always have a guy who's worse, and he antagonizes the audience so that you're hot for him to get killed. You want him to die because you're emotionally invested in his death because he's been such a bastard. Yeah.
Right. You want him dead.
That's where we're at, too, is that Bond, the Russian girl, and his buddy, the Turkish buddy, all get on a train and escape with the decoder. But the assassin for Spectre basically kills his way through the train, takes out the Russian agent they'd managed to capture, kills Ali's character, and that's when Bond starts to get upset because his friend is dead, and he actually full-on punches the Russian girl in the face,
mm-hmm.
trying to get information from her, realizes that she doesn't have any information, and then the psycho finally gets a drop on them. And so they've been playing this cat-and-mouse thing all throughout the movie.
Yeah, that was another no-no for the time. You never hit a woman.
And with a closed fist besides.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, she never showed any sign of that. The guy drugs the girl, too. It's like, without her consent. But it just bugged me because he's on script throughout the movie, and then right there at the end, he has to go full psycho just to make you mad at him, just so that you're good about with Bond killing this guy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really not that. It's an okay action sequence, but Bond tricks him into turning on the tear gas. But it doesn't actually do anything. They're both in a tightly closed room.
Yeah, it's like, almost like it was a momentary stunt.
Right,
And see, that's something I can tell you about. I've been tear gassed. If it was tear gas, especially tear gas of that era, you wouldn't have seen it, for one.
Yeah.
And for another, I'm telling you, you get a dose of tear gas, you're going down, baby. And it's one, just inhale just one breath of it. And I'm telling you, you're going to be on the ground. Your eyes are going to be watering. Your throat is burning so bad you can't breathe. The needle pricks. It's like your entire body feels like needles are hitting you. People don't understand tear gas. And anybody that's ever actually experienced tear gas will tell you what I'm telling you is exactly the truth. You cannot get used to tear gas. It is a biological weapon. It's like nerve gas. It is kind of a nerve gas. It'll drop you. And, you know, mustard gas was a big thing in World War One, and I think it was still used some in World War Two. And I've heard what mustard gas does to you. But in the movies, it's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
You know. But tear gas is odorless, colorless, and tasteless. And, you know, I don't know if they still do it. I think somebody told me they stopped doing it. But it used to be part of military military training for the United States. I know that's how it happened to me.
Bond finally kills the Red Grant character. I think that it was a pretty damn good Bond villain. The actor went on to play Quint in Jaws and do some other stuff. He was actually a novelist, too. I think he did a really good job about being one of those mostly silent, you know, villains. My only issue is when he actually starts talking, and I know he's putting on a performance. Hey, Chuck, good man, old man, you know, we're here to help. M sent me to help you out. But it did take away from his menace. It should have added to it, but he was just such a dandy that it just took away
and
from...
And that is one of the parts of the movie that I couldn't help but notice. Going back to what you're saying about Bond, so, I mean, you know, let's face it, led up to him being able to cock Bond over the back of the head after Bond was holding a gun on him.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of those. And it looked forced to me. It was, you know, they talked a lot about he was a very talented writer and other things in real life, but he really liked being an actor.
He liked the financial security. He said that, you know, there's 100 English authors with multiple books under their who can't afford lunch.
Right.
So he'd much rather be an actor thing.
Well, okay. So, but to me, that was, that whole scene was bad acting on his part.
Mm.
You know, I mean, he came off as totally insincere.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was meant or if it was bad acting. I'm not enough of a critic to try to voice an opinion on that. I just know, to me, it seemed like bad acting.
Yeah. So Bond kills Red Grant. Him and the girls steal a truck and go off into, you know, at this point, it's supposed to be somewhere in Europe, I believe. And they're attacked by a helicopter. A helicopter's dropping grenades in their path, forcing them to ground. And then Bond is up on a hill trying to evade these helicopters that keep sweeping by. And my understanding is they use miniatures for some of that, but it still looks really freaking cool and really dangerous to see these helicopters swooping at Bond and Bond dodging it and such.
Well, I know they did not have remote control helicopters at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's I think we spoke of this before. Helicopters was a rare thing. I knew what helicopters were.
Mm-hmm.
But I had seen one on a Coast Guard base in Corpus Christi, Texas, which would have been about 1963. You didn't see helicopters flying around like you fly now. And so the use of a helicopter in that, you can compare to the gyrocopters used in the 70s Bond films. You know, people just didn't see that stuff. Helicopters were a really rare thing. And when you did see them in this country, they didn't look like that.
Mm-hmm.
There was a couple of basic models of helicopter they had, but you didn't have TV stations didn't have helicopters. I remember some movies that were made in the early 60s, and one that I know that was made in 1959. Helicopters weren't a World War II thing. They were something that came along late in the Korean War. I mean, they had helicopters, but I mean, as far as knowing their use and being used practically on a regular basis, there was only Sikorsky and one other company here in America produced helicopters, and the ones that people were familiar with was that same style of helicopter, but it was shorter and bulkier and had large gas tanks that were visible. It was almost science fiction. That's why they were using it in a Bond film.
I think I read on the wiki page that virtually every other Bond movie since has had a helicopter sequence.
Yeah, because I mean, they got a good response from that stuff. I mean, they always use some kind of STOL flying something in Bond movies, you know. Mm-hmm.
So Bond manages to get behind some rocks, construct a sniper rifle, and shoot the co-pilot in the arm before he can drop a grenade. Helicopter explodes. Cool moment, too. I thought it looked neat watching the cabin blow up. And so he and the girl end up on a boat with a whole lot of gas tanks on the back. You said that's enough gas to get pretty much anywhere in the world. My immediate thought is, oh, that shit's going to blow up. And of course...
They looked oversized. I mean, you know, they looked like they were larger than 55 gallons.
Mm-hmm.
They looked more like almost double that. And they were on a rolling platform as if they were depth charges, which I am sure was a deliberate thing.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you get to the use part of it.
Yeah, because the Russia, the Spectre agents, was it Spectre or the Russians that were coming after them at that point? Spectre, right?
Yeah, Spectre. Yeah.
So Spectre is committed to a boat chase with them.
Yeah, they had five motorcraft.
Yeah, they were firing upon them, which caused causes all that gasoline to start leaking into the water. Bond starts pushing the barrels into the water, and then he fires a flare that blows up a good chunk of that area and roasts the Spectre agent. And what's interesting about that to me is it's been a long time since I've seen the stuntman on fire. I used to see that all the time. And I was like, man, yeah, those practical effects, you know, that used to be a big deal. You don't see it anymore.
Yeah, and then one of those guys, before he goes over, I'm almost convinced was actually burning.
I looked into it, and apparently several of those got the fire got out of control. It was done at Pinewood. It wasn't actually on set.
Right.
It got out of control, and at least one of those guys, like, eyelids were on fire.
Mm.
So it's like, oh, that's probably why they don't set people on fire as much anymore, because people freaking died from that shit.
Mm.
Probably OSHA shut that stuff down, or just,
you know, found a practice. OSHA in England.
Right. But I'm saying something approximate to that. But it used to be, man, that used to be like a go-to thing. You would always set somebody on fire in one of these action movies. And it occurred to me when I was watching it, I was like, man, it's been a long time since I've seen that happen. That's probably why. So Bond and the girl get away, and they're on a boat at the end, and that's when they finally start playing the theme from Russia with Love. And it occurs to me that the Spectre agents had filmed Bond on his first night with Natalia, or whatever her name is. And that's like the first celebrity sex tape, because they were threatening to, like, blackmail him.
Actually,
and
he dumped him into the river. You can look at it that way. You compare it to a sex tape. Yeah. You know, it was 8mm instead of, you know, done with a computer lens or whatever, you know, but yeah.
When I was a kid, I had a cassette tape where they had committed most of the major James Bond themes up through to, I think, Octopussy. I think the last one on there was All Time High by Rita Coolidge. And so what I would do is I'd put that cassette in, and I had, of all the action figures I had at this point, but I had one of the Fisher-Price Adventure People. And it was the helicopter pilot. He had like a blue outfit with a headset, and he was blonde. And for some reason, he was my secret agent guy. And so I'd play that cassette tape and have my guys have their little spy adventure throughout, and the soundtrack of the spy adventure would be all those James Bond themes. And so after the initial James Bond theme, they would go into From Russia with Love. And so typically my little adventures would start around Russia and involve the Russians. I mean, it was still the Cold War, so we were still afraid of a nuclear winter happening, you know. But I had always thought that it was one of the weak links of the Bond themes. And especially as a kid, I didn't have an appreciation for 50s music that I have today, or that type of 50s music. And it's still a kind of a cheesy song. I like the lyrics better than a lot of the Bond songs. I remember that song. I can sing that song in my head more easily than a lot of Bond songs, because the words are so distinct. But it's because the guy has that cheesy, you know, mid-century delivery. I tend to think of it still being as a somewhat weaker song, although it still is good about capturing that international intrigue aspect. Like a lot of the ones from the latter part of that cassette tape, the stuff from the late 70s, early 80s, they're just love songs. You know, they're just pop hits. So I'm very ambivalent about that song. I like aspects of it, and then other parts of it I find cheesy. What do you think of the song?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things that are endearing to me that you find cheesy.
Mm-hmm.
It's all right. I don't believe I have it in my playlist, you know. But I do have a lot of Bond songs on my playlist, come think of it, but as far as forming opinion, I'm not disco dancing to it. You know, that's about as good to it as I can get it.
So just a few general things about the movie. It was released in 1963. It was filmed at least in part in Turkey, but they had to film a lot of stuff that was intended for Turkey in the UK in order for them to have certain breaks for it to be an English film as far as they were concerned. So a lot of it got shot at Pinewood because of that. But they didn't have legit Turkish shots, and some of the shots are really great. It's a great looking city. It had a $2 million budget, which was twice as much as Dr. No had. And I do see some of that on the screen, but because of the lack of the cool base at the end of the movie, I don't know that and because of how gorgeous the Caribbean shots were in the first movie, I still don't like the look of this movie as much as I like Dr. No. It doesn't have as many highs. It's like pretty throughout, but like the underground cavern sequences didn't do as much for me. The train sequences didn't do as much for me. It felt more like a typical action movie. It didn't quite reach Bond levels.
And I'm going to tell you, I remember, and I was thinking about the cavern scene myself last night. I, when I was younger, thought that was the coolest scene.
Mm-hmm.
And last night, I remember thinking that the rats ruined it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because, you know, he's talking about, because it's a for real place, for one thing.
Uh-huh.
And he's explaining the history of it and how it was a reservoir for clean water.
Yeah, Constantinople put it in.
Right.
Constantine, Emperor Constantine.
That's right. And Emperor Constantine.
I'm thinking of Istanbul, well, not Constantinople.
We were talking about this outside of movie.
Uh-huh.
Constantine was the Roman ruler that made Christianity all right. If it hadn't been for Constantine, the Catholic Church would not exist. So,
well, my understanding is the motivation was that all the polytheism was making it hard to rule all the people because everybody was worshiping different gods at different temples and such. And so Constantine elevated Christ as the one God in part because that meant that he could use the word of the one God on all these people.
Constantine was superstitious. He had a dream. He had a dream of a cross with a sun shining behind it. And he, when he woke up from the dream, he decided that it was by this symbol he would conquer. He would conquer Rome and the world. Okay, and part of his rule, you know, he was sharing rule, and he wanted it all. But and that this is not theology. This is actual fact that historians and anthropologists know. There are writings on the subject. Writings done by Constantine. So they know. No, it's the truth, and it's how the Catholic Church first formed. But you know, the Catholicism actually happened after Constantine, but that was the beginning of the church, and that's why one home of the Catholic Church is Constantinople, and one is the Vatican in Rome, outside of Rome, as a city-state. And that's why there's two Catholic churches, too. So he not only created it, but he divided it.
So the writing on this movie was difficult because the original screenwriter wanted to stick closer to the Ian Fleming book. The director specifically was taking a lot of liberties, wanting to go in different directions, and they apparently was they were messing with the screenplay throughout the filming. Despite having double the budget of Dr. No, they still went over budget, the production ran too long. They struggled to hit a date that they'd already set for release. I think that shows. I think that the writing is inconsistent with this movie, and it doesn't really flow as well as it should. There's a lot of stuff that seems to be in there just because it'll look cool. I do think this movie suffers from sequelitis, where they're trying to take all the stuff that people liked from the first movie and do it over again, but do it bigger. There's sequences, particularly when Bond first arrives in Turkey, where it's basically the exact same sequence as happened in Dr. No, with just little tweaks to it. I didn't like the humor in this one as much. Bond himself seemed like kind of an odd entity. I complain about how the Bond girl doesn't have much personality and she seems to only exist to serve Bond's needs, but Bond himself is just sort of there. You know, he doesn't have the charisma that Connery had in the first movie. And again...
No, but he does seem here and there,
mm-hmm,
to find the whole situation humors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, he shows it with his eyes, he grins, he almost sticks his tongue out at one time.
There's the scene in Dr. No where the guy who assassinated was the guy that they're investigating his murder. Okay, so anyway, so the guy tries to murder Bond in his bed, and Bond and the Asian woman that he was sleeping, mm-hmm, with in their bed. Bond gets the drop on him and then executes him in cold blood.
Right.
And I'm sure that was a scene that caught a lot of people by surprise. It wasn't the sort of morality that was approved for American audiences. And I noticed in this movie, Bond keeps sparing people's lives. You know, he kills people. But if he doesn't have to, he chooses not to. And I can see where in that one situation he would feel the need to just execute this guy, because this guy was willing to kill his own people to get at Bond and to do it in the dirtiest way possible. But it seemed like he was almost like a course correction where they want to make a nicer Bond. They want to make him a more agreeable character. And I thought they sometimes overdid it with his being the good guy and applying those American mores to Bond's approach. And I don't know, it just felt like the character just seemed much more flat in this one. And I wonder apparently Time Magazine interviewed Jack Kennedy, and one of Kennedy's 10 favorite books of all time was From Russia With Love, the novel. And the last movie Kennedy saw before getting killed in Dallas was From Russia With Love. I'm wondering what he thought of those liberties, if he would have had an issue with it. I wonder if Jack Kennedy had a fanboy moment where he's like, it wasn't as good as the book.
I don't know. I think, to tell you the truth, that, you know, when I was in the military, the ship I was on before we came back to the United States was a flagship, and it had to change flags with the incoming flagship because we were coming offline, they were coming online. You've got helicopters. Our first stop was going to be Australia, and then our next stop stop was going to be Japan. And at that time, American military, there was a treaty where we weren't supposed to bring our nuclear weapons into Japanese waters. And since we would be docking in Japan, the ship could not have any nuclear weapons on it, supposedly. Well, nuclear weapons, when they're transferred from carrier to carrier, have to be transferred by helicopter. A lot of the other arms being transferred, you know, when they get loaded in your own online when you're at war, a lot of them, the helicopter comes down and hooks up to these big bundles of bombs and what have you, and carries them over and lands them on the deck of the carrier. Then they're taken down by elevator and all that stuff. So you got these tender ships in there. You got a lot of frigates. There's at least four or five frigates running around guarding the two ships, because in this situation, it's probably one of the times that a U.S. carrier would be the most vulnerable. And there's submarines underneath you, and you know they're there. You don't see them, but you know it's a fact. Anyway, from time to time, you would see Russian trawlers, and you knew what they were doing there. And they would hang out for a little while, and then they'd be told, you better get out of here, and they would disappear. And in this case, there was a Russian trawler. I could see it from the ship myself. Somewhere I have pictures. And of course, in my picture, you can tell there's something on the ocean. You can't really tell it's a trawler. But I do have pictures where you can see the helicopter stuff. Anyway, all this is going on, and I'm watching it, and we're about complete. I mean, we've been doing this all day with the USS Enterprise. I've been watching it off and on all day, and I'm out there, and then all of a sudden, the helicopters stop moving, and they actually swing out wide away from the ship. And our missile emplacement, which was like right next to my head, above my head, you hear it wind up, and the missiles come flying out onto their launch pod, and the pod, you know, which would normally aim the missiles at the sky, swing over across me and down over the top of my head, aiming at the sea. This had my attention, not to mention I'm backing up, because if those things launch, I'm going to be French fried.
Right.
No battle warning, you know. They drilled us crazy with battle station drills. It was like fire drills. It was just something that you had to live with. And here are these missiles come flying out, and there's no battle station warning. Next thing I know is this Russian troller, which is probably about a mile away, spins around and starts heading in the opposite direction, and this Russian submarine comes out right between the two ships. It was probably 200 yards away from me. He comes flying out of, you know, in an emergency straight up action, comes out and lands on top of the water, and I'm going, wow. And he starts dropping back, and I saw a couple of frigates coming along behind him. He turns around and he runs on the surface. Shortly after that, I see one of our submarines. He didn't quite surface, but I could see him up under the water between us, you know. And after they got that thing out of the way, the missiles flipped back up and backed off and went, you know, emptied off of their launcher. That kind of stuff goes on all the time. I knew it went on. I'd never seen it. I'd seen pictures of, like, we had B-52 jet bombers. The Russians used counter-rotating propeller, huge propeller-operated aircraft that almost flew near jet speed because they had, each engine had counter-rotating propellers. You know, people on both sides would wave at each other. So the theme, you talked about it earlier, the theme in this movie is one of, you know, your enemies, and your enemies are close a lot of times, and it's just a known thing. They're playing games with each other. Mm. And we know this is true. So, you know, when you're talking about Kennedy, what he thought, maybe that's one of the attractions to it. He knew how true it was. Mm-hmm. But you also got to remember, man, we're talking of the age of Khrushchev here.
Yeah.
You know, that was back when you were in school. As often as you had fire drills, we had these civil defense drills that later became a joke.
Duck and cover.
Yeah, duck and cover, you know.
It's easier to kiss your ass goodbye while your head's between your knees.
Yeah, well, but see, I had to do that as a kid.
Yeah.
You know, I was almost, when they stopped doing it, I guess I was just about junior high school. They'd take us in the hall, you know, all the schools were built out of cinder block. They were here, not so much other places.
Apropos.
There you go. We'd have to go
in. You can
in.
Cut that off, though.
We... we'd have to go in the hallway and they would shut the classroom door so that we would be nowhere near windows and stuff. Mm-hmm. And there would come a point in time we'd duck and cover. We'd squat, put our head between our knees, and then cover our heads with our hands. That way you couldn't see the big flash, and we were told it would save our lives, you know. And I can remember thinking, shouldn't my back be, shouldn't my face be towards the water? But then when I was a teenager, somebody made a poster, you know, about putting your head between your legs and kissing your ass. But I remember...
Well, I guess the government wanted to make the piles as small as possible for easy vacuuming.
Well, actually, they wanted us to believe we were tougher and we could survive because we were ready.
Right.
You know, they didn't disassemble all that civil defense stuff until almost 1980. Mm. That's, at least in Houston, that's when they started disassembling the stuff.
Mm-hmm. I remember those sirens, though. All throughout my children here to hear those.
Look, we still have one here. They use it for the volunteer fire department.
Mm.
I hear the civil defense. Hey, and this has been, it hasn't gone off this weekend, so apparently nobody's got a fire. Of course, you know, it's 80 degrees outside. Uh-huh. Yeah, when they want the volunteer fire department in this town to load up and go out, they set off that defense. You know, it's only spitting distance from this house, so it's pretty loud when it goes off.
Yeah. So what did you think of the movie, though, overall?
I like the movie. I like all the Bond films. And yeah, there are some I like better than others. And I don't think compare the older ones with the newer ones. I mean, let's face it. Our current Daniel Craig Bond is a vicious killer. And he has no qualms about killing. He does it as easy as scratching his ass. We're talking about two different sensibilities. I do know in 1963 that a real James Bond would have been just like the Daniel Craig. But for 1963, that was not for public consumption.
In looks and in build, Red Grant is more like Daniel Craig than Sean Connery is.
I don't know. I mean, I always thought Daniel Craig looked like he was a little guy.
No, but he's muscular, though.
Oh, he's muscular.
He's muscular,
yeah.
And he's blonde, and he's taciturn in those old movies. So in that, he comes off, he has a greater resemblance to the assassin in this movie.
More in common with the assassin than Bond does. Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
Which one did you like better of the first two, though?
I really don't. Like I said, I'm not so critical.
You either like it or you don't. You know, it's not about...
I do. I don't... you brought up being so much like a sequel and stuff. I just don't dissect them that critically. I can see some of your points, but for me, they're two different films, and I don't really see them as sequels, one less than the other. And the next one we watch, you know, you say it, people say it was the best of the early.
Well, that's just it. I was looking it up. Apparently, a lot of people think that From Russia with Love was the best Bond movie as well.
Well, you know, it's like I always say. You know, I do a lot of review, but when it comes to movies and music, I don't really review them. I do review the 3D in movies from a technical point, because I don't see that as being a movie critic. I see that as a technological observance.
Consumer Reports.
It's a consumer report. I mean, people that like 3D, like I like 3D, they don't want to see a lot of artistic direction. They want to see good 3D. They don't want to see soft focus. The whole point of 3D is to see it sharp and clear as if you're there. That's my motto. That is what I review. To me, it's a matter of taste. What you're looking for in a film. And as far as I'm concerned, for the type of film these Bond films are, it's an honest question to ask me which one I like better than the other. But in these first two films, they're equal in my eyes. I can't see them any other way. And perhaps if I'd been older and did see them in the movies at two different times, maybe I'd have more to say. But it's just like Our Man Flint and In Flight Flint. I actually did see those in the theaters when they came out. And when Our Man Flint, after watching it for five times, you know, we just thought it was the greatest thing in the world, me and my cousin did. We couldn't wait for a sequel to come out, and the very next summer we got one.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wanted to ask me which was the better movie, Our Man Flint or In Like Flint, I would tell you that out of the two, the best scene was the Turkish toilet scene.
Well, don't go into too much detail. I think we're going to cover the
Well, I know that, but yeah. The point I'm making is, yet there was one movie that had a better scene than the other movie, but that does not mean that it was a better movie overall.
Yeah.
Those two movies, in my eyes, are equal.
Mm-hmm.
So, in this case, I have to say these two movies are equal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And a wrap.
Can you hear me? Are you recording or what? The 108th age, Adam Thornton, and I'm freak, and I'm nostalgia. Batter, Bally, No to Bigotry, Biko to Django, Chris at Bat Books for Beginners, Chronosphere Fiction, Copy and Comic, Collected Edition, Comics in the Golden Age, Connor Stone, Daniel French, Fish Bonus Sound Design, Dave Golding, Doc Strange, El Romero Mero, Gafgarn, The Eternally Unfurnished, Gregory Litchfield, The Hammer Strike, Random Geek Stuff, History of Comics on Film, Ibrahim Khan, Into the Weird, Iowa's Joe Crawford, Jeffrey Brown, John Horsley, Keith G. Baker, Kevin Barnhide, King Dinosaur, Chris Thanos, Lola Pat, Longbot Crusade, Martin Gray, Myrna Loy, Nexus of All Realities, Odell Abner Dracula, Paul Matthew Carr, Randy Andrews, Ranger Gord, Resurrection, and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, Richard G, Shaloctopus, Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Steve Sellers, Trekker Talk, and that is the list.
The preceding program is intended for the common good at no expense to any citizen. It should therefore be considered to possess a license to thrill in service to fair use, and not seen as a hostile act against copyright owners in the international marketplace. As always, should any of our agents be compromised regardless, we will disavow any knowledge of their activities. This transmission will self-destruct in 5 seconds.